You are listening to the Improv Save My Life podcast, brought to you on Bits, the Boston Improv Talk Station.
All right, welcome to episode 88 of the Improv Save My Life podcast. I'm your host, Tom Boyer. The guest this week is producer extraordinaire Kevin Quigley. What's going on, Kevin?
Not much. How are you?
I'm doing good, thanks. I'm going to go through Kevin's credits real quick. Kevin is a producer of a bunch of shows. He produces weekly shows at Johnny D's, including Johnny D's Comedy Presents in Davis Square, which is a stand-up show, correct?
Yeah, stand-up and storytelling.
You also co-produce Phoenix Landing Comedy Presents in Central Square, which is also stand-up?
Yeah, stand-up and storytelling, yeah.
Is that kind of your standard format?
Yeah, for those two shows, I do like... I'll have usually two stand-up nights a month, and then a storytelling night, and then like a theme night. So those are fun.
Cool. Yeah. You're also a producer of Sketch House at IB.
Every week.
Producer of the improv troupe The Con Men.
Yeah.
Which is Connor Allen, Sam Mike,
Pete Fenzel, Sasha Goldberg. All them. It's weird. They're so weird.
You're also the creator and producer of a storytelling show called Wild Memory Nation.
I am. Yeah, that's the one that goes up once a month on one of those two bar shows. And then I also have it once a month at Sketch House. So that's a scripted storytelling show based on a single theme.
So you're big into storytelling.
Yeah.
I take it.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to make a storytelling night happen in Boston for about 5 years, and I finally did it. So
nice.
Yay me.
You also direct the sketch comedy group World of Hurt.
World of Hurt. And our next show is on the 30th.
And that's at IB?
At IB, yeah, in Sketch House. We're going to have the headlining slot in there. So it's going to be all new stuff. It's going to be neat.
And you've also recently produced some pretty big shows at IB, including Super Gay Comedy Fun Time and Comedy America.
That's right. Super Gay Comedy Fun Time. That was a fun one because we've been at Sketch House. It's been like it was a kickoff to Pride Week at Sketch House the first time we did it, and then we decided to do it later last year, and it was another sold out run at Sketch House, and so I pitched it as a main stage show this year, and we sold out like in the giant theater, and I was like, yes,
nice.
So yeah, that was really cool. Doing it on as the kickoff to Pride Week was a big deal. We got a lot of people coming in. We had like storytellers. It was a variety show, which is something I like doing. I like making variety happen.
Yeah, I agree. I like that as well.
Well, it's fun because I can produce it. And basically, I can let the directors and the storytellers and whatever do their own thing, and then just make sure that they're going to be good. You know, I don't have to be there every week, so I get all the fun of producing without all the hassle, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Unless a group goes over or someone backs out, and then I have to like go into full producing mode. That's fun.
And tonight's the last night of Comedy America, so this is probably, if you're listening to this, it's probably already come and passed. But
it'll be back probably next summer. You know, last year, Alan McRae and I, he's the director, we noticed that Improv Boston tended to have not a lack of shows in the summer, but you know, people didn't tend to have epic shows in the summer, and we're like, well, why don't we do an epic sketch show, and you know, make it really fun and have be a comedy review and have music in it, and make it like the holiday shows, because their holiday shows like Gore Fest and the Winter Spectacular always bring in so many people, so we wanted to do that in the middle of the summer.
It's a great idea, as I think a lot of theaters do gear more towards like a Christmas show and then like a Halloween show.
Mm-hmm.
IA does the same thing.
Yeah.
And they don't really have a summer show. That's an awesome idea.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I mean, basically we vaguely centered it around 4th of July last year. We did some more American history sketches. And those were fun. Those were super duper fun. But this year we wanted to just get to like, we wanted to sort of do kind of dumber sketches, you know, and that were a little sillier, and not as highbrow. We had one sketch last year that was that were hipster gold miners, and that they, you know, gold was over. They were gonna mine for hexlite or whatever. So yeah, that was kind of fun. But yeah, so this year, and it's been really successful. You know, we had all new music this year. We had mostly new sketches, mostly a new cast. It's a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. I think we're going to super duper sell out tonight. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be neat.
Cool. So where are you from originally?
I am from a lot of places, but mainly the South Shore. So Quincy, Taunton, Hull, Weymouth, Braintree.
Do you live in the South Shore now?
No, I live in Somerville now. So, yeah, I graduated. So I lived in a lot of these places when I was much younger, and then I moved to Taunton with my dad, and then we lived there, and I graduated. I did freshman year of high school there, and then moved to Braintree and did the rest of my high school there, and I did a little bit of theater in high school, but not much. But yeah, so so as soon as I graduated high school, I moved to Quincy, which is just the next town over. And
yeah, that I live in Dorchester, so yeah. I spent a lot of time in Quincy. Like a lot of my friends lived in Quincy.
Oh yeah, yeah. My first boyfriend was lived in Dorchester, so I would take the train from Quincy to Dorchester for 5 years.
It's a pain in the ass because you have to switch over. You have to go all the way to JFK. Well, I live near Ashmont, so I had to go if I want to do that, I have to go to JFK and then back to Ashmont from Quincy.
Sucks.
But I drive, so it doesn't happen. Used to happen.
I don't have a car. I've never had a car. I've never driven. I don't even have a license. That might be changing, but because I might move to California in 5 years.
This is a weird thing. Joe Gale's just posted something about wanting to
get a license. I saw that, and he said that, and I was like, you know what? I'm not the only adult that doesn't drive. So Danielle Andruskowitz said that she was going to try to teach us. So that's her death warrant. It's not going to work out well.
You should film that.
Yeah. I mean, I have a friend who doesn't know how to ride a bike, which I think is interesting. He's like 38, and he doesn't know how to ride a bike, and I think that's interesting, too.
I probably haven't been on a bike in 15 years, but...
Really?
I know they say you never forget, but I would not be comfortable just topping on.
Sure, I'll just do this. Yeah, it's fun. I mean, once they did Hubway here, I didn't have a bike, and then they did the Hubway thing, and I started riding everywhere, and I was like, oh, my God, because I used to walk just everywhere, take public transportation, and I'm like, I can do this. I can be places everywhere, and then I went out and got a bike of my own, so now it's like I have this freedom that I never had before.
I have several recurring dreams, and one of them is me, like, biking everywhere all of a sudden.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that, you know?
I don't know.
That's so weird.
But, like, really far distances, too, and people are, like, impressed when I get there.
Really? You're like, oh, look, you're in California. Wait, no. Why did you? Yeah, when I first got the bike, I thought that I was going to go in marathons, like bike marathons, and I was going to drive up to Maine on my bike, and that didn't happen at all because there are hills.
I bought this pretty expensive Lance Armstrong indoor bike, the Livestrong bike. You could do the whole tour on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I saw it on ESPN, and I was like, this was back when I was drinking, and I was like, I want that. And I just ordered it.
I'll take that right now.
I still have it, and I still intend to use it at some point, but I've intended to use it for the last 2 years. So.
Well, stationary bikes are weird for me, because they're not – I like to get places. Like, I like to have a termination point. So, I'm getting home, or I'm getting to the theater, or I'm going, to Davis Square. Because if it's just stationary, then I'm just staring into space, and that, and I listen to audiobooks. That's like, that's where I listen to, because I go to the gym all the time, so I listen to books way more than I read them nowadays, which is kind of annoying to me, because I used to have time to just sit and read a book, but now I do so many things that I don't.
I just took the free subscription to Audible, like free month subscription, but I've just been listening to, like, comedy books for the most part, but I do like to read a little bit, like fiction, but I would wonder what the and I listen to like podcasts on my way to work, but I would wonder what like listening to like a novel would be like, because I feel like I'd lose focus and then I'd miss half of it.
Yeah, I mean, you think that at first it's a different way, but if I think everybody remembers being read to as a kid, and I think you sort of get back into that. Because that's sort of what triggered it to me. The first audiobook I ever read was Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and he read it, so I was like, oh, I now get British humor, and so that was kind of fun. And then I'm a huge Stephen King fan, so I started listening to the books that he read first, because he's read a few, and some of them are terrible. His early ones are terrible because he didn't know how to read out loud, and then they're great. And then it just came from there. So I would recommend if you want to get into it, like listen to a book that you think is a favorite first, and then go back and then you can continue from there. Because there, I mean, I've never until this year or last year, I'd never like sat down and read a book by Lawrence Block. He's a mystery writer, and I just listened to them, and I had never had any problems. So it all depends on the reader too. I listened to Moby Dick this year for the first time ever, and there's this reader named Frank Muller, who unfortunately is dead now, but he was considered an audiobook superstar. So if you can find a book by Frank Muller, he will make you enjoy it no matter how dull it is. I'm actually listening to The Green Mile again for the seventh time, and he read that, and it's really, really good. So
that's a full-length book, right?
Yeah.
Because he had a couple of short stories that were made into movies, right?
Mm-hmm. Stephen King?
Yeah.
Yeah, Green Mile actually originally came out in 6 installments.
Oh, yeah.
So in 1996, and I always thought that was the coolest thing. Like, the first part was in April, and the last part was in August, and I just remember everybody being like, what's going to happen? And I got the third installment a day early because I went into this convenience store, and they were selling it when they weren't supposed to. And I read it, and I was like, ah, and this was like when the internet was just starting, and I told all my friends that I had read it. I was like, oh, I read this, and they're like, where are you? So it was the best day.
That's the best when, like, you accidentally stumble upon something early. Like, I remember the 1989 Batman movie.
Mm-hmm.
I just was obsessed with, and I knew it was coming out on, let's say, November 23rd on video. So I pre-ordered it. And this is before anybody pre-ordered anything, really, at this little video store down the street from my house. And then my mom was at CVS, like, the night before it was supposed to come out, and she's like, they have Batman here.
Whoa!
I'm like, oh, no, but I already pre-ordered. She's like, you can get your money back for that.
I can just cancel that pre-order
for you if you want. And I was like, yes. And it was like, I had it a night earlier. I was just like, this is crazy.
Did you sit down and, like, watch immediately? Yeah. That's awesome. That was a good movie.
It was. I like, had the trading cards, and I just I'm still pretty obsessed with Batman, but that's, like, what kind of started it. And then, I saw that movie, I went back and read the comics, mm-hmm. like, from the past. For 10 years, but that sweet spot where you'd be really into comics, I was, like, super into comics. I had a barber once that said, So I used to get, like, ridiculous haircuts, like flat tops with, like, the lines cut in the sides.
Oh, yep, we all had them.
But he was like, I just got these stencils in you. I can put, like, a bat symbol in your head.
Oh,
if
my
you
God.
Want. And then he's like, I also got these markers that will, like, stay in your, like, skin for, like, a week or something. And so he colored it in blue. And I thought it was so cool. And then I went to school the next day, and I was mocked mercilessly.
Oh, no. Oh,
and it wouldn't come out either.
You're like, did you start wearing hats then? You're like, oh, this is...
Well, then they started calling me Robin, which I'm like, I love Batman.
Yeah. Okay, I'll take it. It was weird, you know, because that came out, and I tried to get into superhero. I bought Dark Knight, Dark City, like that whole miniseries. Yeah. I was like, I didn't know that Batman could be this creepy. And then I stayed away from superhero comics. And I went to high school, and all my friends were into, you know, the Avengers and X-Men and all this other stuff. And I had no interest. I pretended to. I got into Sandman. Not Sandman. Oh, God, what was it? Dark Hawk and Sleepwalker.
Dark Hawk. It was great. I loved Dark Hawk.
I did, too.
The first issue of Dark Hawk, I used to have I smoke now, like, fucking chimney, but I used to have, like, bad asthma when I was a kid. I remember I was in the hospital, and, like, I had to stay overnight. And my dad just grabbed, like, a handful of comics. Like, he wasn't, like, going through them. Like, my son would like this one. But one of them was Dark Hawk number one, and it just sticks with me. I'll always remember that.
And so, yeah, I mean, it was weird because I got really into those two because they were brand new at the time.
Yeah, I think they came out within a month of each other or something like that.
Yeah, and all my friends, and then I got into Spider-Man, but this is the 90s, so everything was all like you had to buy die-cast covers and all this other stuff. And then the Infinity Gauntlet came out, and I didn't get it because I was just new into comics. And then my friend, I was broke too as a kid. So my friend said, well, you have to buy all these 12 issues to understand the story. And I said, I give up. And I stopped reading superhero comics and went straight into horror comics. And I read it because EC was reprinting all their Tales from the Crypt back then. So I just started reading Tales from the Crypt and all those. And that's what I was into.
Stephen King's son does Lock and Key. I don't know if you read that.
He does, and I don't know why I have the first trade of Lock and Key. I love Joe Hill. I've read all three of his novels, and for some reason I can't get into Lock and Key. I don't know why. I will eventually, and apparently there's going to be an audiobook.
I just saw that too, which is weird.
Yeah, I think they're going to act it out. It's going to be like a radio play, and Stephen King himself is going to be doing one of the parts.
Which there was a pilot a couple of years ago that I think you can actually find online for a Lock and Key show.
Really?
It just didn't get picked up by Fox.
Oh, yeah. That's sad. I don't know why Horns didn't do well. I didn't ever see it in the theaters. That, like, Daniel Radcliffe was in it, and he was supposed to be pretty good, but I didn't.
I don't think people buy into Daniel Radcliffe as anything but Harry Potter.
It sucks. I mean, eventually, you know, like Sean Connery got to not be Bond, but it took a while.
Yeah.
So.
And Daniel Radcliffe's making some interesting choices, like that he's trying to separate himself. It's just, I mean, I would have a hard time with it too. Like, I can't see him being like a romantic lead or anything.
Not yet, at least. I mean, he's still like Leonardo DiCaprio. He still looks like he's super young, and I still remember him as that.
I think what his best bet would be like to partner up with like James Franco and Seth Rogen, and just be like kind of like what Michael Cera did, and just be like a parody of himself. It just sort of show like some range and like some humor.
Do some comedies.
I mean, he was in
Extras, right?
Yeah, yeah, he was really good in that.
Yeah, he was really funny in that. Yeah, that was yeah. But for some reason, Emma Watson can do whatever she wants.
Yeah,
she was in Spring Breakers, and she was it Spring Breakers that she was in.
Oh, no, this is the end.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But then she also did that Sofia Coppola movie where people broke into houses of the Bling Ring. And now she's going to be in Beauty and the Beast, live-action Beauty and the Beast.
Nice.
I'm a huge Disney fan. I got my Baloo tattoo.
Are you involved with the show that's happening at IB? The
Part of Your World?
Yeah.
No, not yet. I'm producing Sketch House, so I'm like basically the executive producer, but Marissa Kennedy is actually in charge of it all, so she's looking for writers and actors. So if you want to write for it, you should. Yeah, I've written a couple Disney sketches. I think I'm going to try to bring one in, but we'll see what happens.
What's your favorite animated old school Disney movie, pre-Pixar?
It's either Robin Hood or The Rescuers. Robin Hood's a big deal for me.
So isn't Baloo...
Jungle Book.
Yeah, but isn't he the same model as Friar John?
No, Big John.
Big John.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the same type. And I think they're voiced by the same person.
I think they actually use some of the same cells of animation.
Well, yeah, because in that era, they were reusing everything.
Yeah.
Like, if you go back, and I think if you watch, a dance sequence in Robin Hood, it's the exact same one from Snow White. They just use this. And I don't understand animation enough to know how they do that, because they obviously look differently. Jungle Book and Robin Hood definitely have very similar parts, because Robin Hood's a very weird movie because it's not linear. It's like little episodes.
Yeah.
And they sort of connect, but not entirely. And it's anachronistic. And some people talk like Southern people, and some people are British. It's very strange.
Did you get into the cartoon series that were on, like, in the 90s?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
DuckTales?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to get a Launchpad McQuackduck tattoo at some point. Yeah, I love DuckTales. DuckTales I can watch now, and it's awesome. But I have tried to go back and rewatch Tailspin, and I don't like it as much, which is sad. I never got into Bonkers. I love Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers. And that was all, like, I didn't realize that there was a difference between, like, Disney and other cartoons back then, so I was really into the real Ghostbusters. And then, do you remember there was an actual other Ghostbusters cartoon that from Filmation that came out?
I don't know how they got away with that. But I had heard that might have preceded the Ghostbusters that we know of, you know. That was so, it had a big monkey.
Yeah, it was like a gorilla or something. Because, there was a, Filmation owned a property, the Ghostbusters property, from like the 50s or something, and it was just this dumb, like, movie or something. And then the movie that we know as Ghostbusters came out, and the older people sued or something, and they wanted the rights to it. And what ended up happening was they just shared the name. So that's why the Ghostbusters was called the Real Ghostbusters, because those are the ones that we know. And so they could both do it. They were both legally allowed to do it.
It's just one of those things as a kid, you're like, why are there two Ghostbusters? And like, these are the obvious Ghostbusters.
Everyone knows, even though Egon does not look like that. Have you seen the
None
picture?
None of them look like
no,
that.
No. Have you seen the picture of the new Ghostbusters? Kate McKinnon has Egon's hair from the cartoon.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's amazing. And she's got the glasses. Oh, I can't wait.
Did you watch Senior Hall voiced, what was the Black Ghostbusters?
Winston?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, for like the first three seasons or something. And then when he got his own show, I think he...
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, all I knew was that Peter was voiced by the guy that voiced
Garfield,
and that always freaked me out. I'm like, why does he sound like Garfield? And then I remember reading it.
And then Bill Murray went on to play Garfield.
Yeah, yeah, so it's all like this big, weird human centipede of weirdness and Garfield. Yeah, I always when I was young, I was baffled by that because I read this magazine called Hot Dog. That was out in the 80s and 90s, and I found out that Papa Smurf was also the guy that voiced Papa Smurf also voiced Azrael, and I was like, he can't do that. They're fighting all the time. So,
yeah, some of those voiceovers are crazy. Like, Uncle Phil played Shredder on Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, isn't that so strange?
And, you know, when I think about it, I'm like, oh, yeah, he does sound exactly like Uncle Phil, but you just...
Well, yeah, I got to go back and listen. Yeah, because Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is awesome. It was like... That was one of the best things.
Yeah, I loved Ninja Turtles.
The original cartoon.
That was like one of those cartoons that I'd actually get like amped up when they came on. Like, yeah.
Running around. That theme song and the Indiana Jones theme song always like because I have asthma too, and I couldn't run very hard, but like if my friends played that on their cassette deck, I was like, oh, I can run harder now. So dumb.
So you're a big Springsteen fan too?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love Springsteen.
What's your favorite record?
His favorite album he put out? I love, well, it's a cheat, but I love the 3-disc live, like the 75 through 85.
I don't think that's a cheat.
Yeah, I guess if I had to pick one.
Yeah,
I actually like, which not a lot of people think of, is the Plugged Unplugged one he did.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's a pretty good one, actually. People forget that he had some really good stuff on that tour.
But like studio albums... Just overall album, like front to back.
Yeah.
I'd probably say Born in the USA, but
Born in the USA is so good.
You know, I like other tracks, like off other albums, probably more than.
Well, too, I for the longest time, it was Darkness on the Edge of Town, and I was like, that's amazing. And then I listened to Tunnel of Love, and I was like, oh crap, this is so good, and it's so different from everything else.
Well, it doesn't have the E Street Band.
No, they come in and go, like, but yeah, they're not really in it. And then Magic came out a few years ago, and I was like, oh, this is perfect.
I have only heard a couple tracks off his last two or three albums.
Well, it's weird. You know, people have argued that he's not as popular as he used to be. He's had more number one albums since 2002 than before.
Really?
Yeah. So this is – he is the person with the third most number one albums, tied with Jay-Z after the Beatles and Elvis. So I think that's bizarre.
I was on hold at work the other day, a couple weeks ago, and I heard a song, and I just started typing the lyrics into Google, and it was a song. I can't think of the song right now, but it was off Devils in Dust.
Oh, yeah?
And it was actually a pretty catchy song, and I downloaded it off iTunes. Yeah, like even his newer albums, which, I mean, they don't get radio play. But
not necessarily, which stinks.
But no artists from... the 80s or 90s even get radio play now. You know?
Yeah.
So it's all just newer artists.
Which is fine. I mean, I don't mind top 40 at all. But what I think is cool about Springsteen, and I noticed this because I went to a Bob Seger concert recently, and it was exactly the opposite. When he does a show and has a new album out, he will focus on the new album. And then, you know, he just expects everybody will enjoy the new album. And then he'll do other stuff. But five or six or eight tracks are going to be from the new album. And I think that's kind of cool because he's so confident in his new stuff. Whereas Bob Seger, I saw him recently, and he did a couple songs from the album. The album wasn't great. And then he sat down for most of the like, you go see Springsteen concerts, he's running up and down.
He's
like,
a madman.
He's crazy, and he has a giant band now. And it's just, you know, he's still super dynamic, and he's still coming out with new stuff. And did you know, if you like the live stuff, he's been releasing these live downloads, like once every other month, from eras of his career. So the one that came out 2 months ago was one from the Born in the USA era, just a full concert front to back that's recorded really well. And then yesterday he released one from the Tunnel of Love era, which is so good because he's never released most of those tracks. So I get to hear Brilliant Disguise live. So good.
I just I love Brilliant Disguise. I just downloaded a Elvis Costello version of that. Have you heard that?
Yes, I have. It's actually really good.
Yeah.
I thought he'd get all weird with it, but he just treats it serious.
I like Elvis Costello a lot, too.
I like him enough. I think he might be too smart for me. I think, you know, because he's thinking on all these levels. I have his greatest hits. I have some other stuff. The song he did for the Soprano soundtrack, Complicated Shadows.
I don't know that one.
It's so good. It's just very creepy and, like, it's unusual for him. He's just, like, it's kind of very tense. But yeah, I like, you know, I love Elvis Costello. There's, I think I'm about to get more into him because there's a podcast called Don't Get Me Started, where these comedians from LA talk to other comedians and about their obsessions, and they're really cool. And I started off listening to it because they were talking about Disney theme parks, and then they talked about Billy Joel, who I also like. And then I just started to listen to subjects that didn't interest me because the people interested me, and one of the subjects is Elvis Costello, and so they're going to basically talk to him and ask him where a novice should go. So, you know, so that's so I'm ready to make that step.
Nice. I've been thinking about this improv structure, Bruce Springsteen related, because I can kind of sing like Bruce Springsteen.
Really?
All yeah. Because right. I just always sung around with the radio and just try to make my voice like his, and now I can pretty much do it.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
But I'm trying to learn to play guitar now. It's not going well. But I want to stick with it. And I was thinking of a structure like you just get an ask for, and then whatever it is, you do like, you know, like rants before songs, you, like a lot of times about his father or the war or whatever.
Yep.
but just do like one of those rants based on the suggestion, and then even play like Thunder Road or something, but the tune of Thunder Road, but try to improvise.
But do the rant. Oh, that's so fun.
So do the rant and a little bit of a song inspired by a suggestion, then just do like maybe a montage after that.
You know, when I went out to Arby's when I was a kid. Love, that sounds fun. I wonder how many people would get into that.
That's what I was thinking. Like maybe you and me.
And there's this guy that does his stage name is Uke Springsteen. Ever seen him?
I saw him. He did the last 24-hour show they have at IA.
Yeah.
I didn't know who he was, but he was playing a ukulele and singing Springsteen songs, so I'm assuming it's the same guy.
He's so funny. He's so funny. I've done a couple of music-oriented shows at Johnny D's, and he's played there. That's the one I had Keytar Bear on. I just had him show up. but I'm doing another music-oriented show at a comedy show at IB coming up in September, I think I'm going to have him on, so I'll let you know.
Nice. We have kind of a co-music-related thing happening at Johnny D's in September.
Oh, yeah? What is it?
Well, you're working with me on it.
That's right. Yeah.
Rhythm and Laughs.
That's right. Yes, yes, yes.
Which is a show I started a couple months ago at the Riot, which features a singer-songwriter, different singer-songwriter each time playing their own acoustic music, or I've had a keyboard player, I've had a guitar player. They do five or six of their own songs, and then in between each song, myself and another improviser talk to them about it, and then about the lyrics, and then we just do montages based on the lyrics or inspired by the lyrics. And it's honestly, out of any of the shows I've done, it's the most fun.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I recommend it the most out of anything I've done. It's because it brings music and improv together. It brings two different audiences together, and it's just fun, like to see one piece of art and then have that explored into another piece of art.
I love that stuff. That, I mean, that's why I've been trying to bring music and comedy together. Like, we're doing the rock and roll comedy power hour, as we're calling it, even though it's an hour and a half. And yeah, I'm bringing in, like, Christine Ahn, who does a ukulele, Ben Quick, who plays guitar, and just a lot of other really great music artists who also do comedy. So it's going to be interesting to see people that actually like good music maybe coming in and then also like comedy coming in. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, definitely. So I think we kind of got away from you.
Oh. No, I love talking. You talked about all the stuff I like.
So how did you get involved with, like, comedy and producing comedy?
Well, okay, so I used to work with a couple people at a job, like an office job, and they were improvisers. And so they said, hey, you know, do you like to laugh? And I'm like, well, this is when Whose Line Is It Anyway was on TV. So I was like, well, I like that show. Like, okay, well, you know, we do improv. Why don't you come up and see some improv? So they were doing the show in a vault, and I don't remember where it was, but it was downtown, and I would go every single week and have chocolate mousse and watch them do improv. And I was like, this is hilarious. And then one of them, I don't remember who it was, I think it might have been Ben Scuria, moved over to IB, and he's like, well, why don't you come see shows here? And I did, and I fell in love with it. And so for a while, I was going every weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, because I don't get into things lightly. I have to commit.
Yeah.
I realized I was going broke. And then for like 1 month, they were offering this lifetime pass for $350 to Improv Boston. I was the only person that bought it. Then.
Is it still valid?
Oh yeah, I still have it in my wallet. I've had it. I've had it now for 12 years. It paid for itself in 3 months. So I've. Even when I don't work there or whatever, I get a free pass to Ivy for any nice. Show. It's great.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But I would go there forever, and then people kept saying, you know, why don't you work here? Why don't you do this? And I said, I want to preserve the magic of it. I don't want to know what goes on behind the scenes. But slowly but surely, I started. First, I was working there for a while, and then sometimes people would have me come in and like read a line on stage or whatever. And then what happened was the current producers of Sketch House said, hey, you come here literally every week. You're the only person that loves sketch this much. Do you want to co-produce with us? And I said, sure. And I spent 3 hours writing up something I called the Sketch Manifesto. Then I said, this is how I want the show to be. And they're like, what did you do? it was literally 6 pages. And I sent it to the current the people that were running Improv Boston then and them. And they're like, well, you've obviously thought about this way more than we have. So I co-produced it for a while. They brought me in to co-produce. And I got really hyper into it, and I was like, I want to do all these really interesting things. And my co-producers were like, we just want to kind of enjoy this. So I took over and I said, I based it the way I really wanted to see it. And then when I got the producing bug, then Sam Ike actually said, hey, do you want to produce this improv thing or this, it was a sketch thing. He said, do you want to produce this thing? And 2 weeks into it, it was called Sketch Avengers. It was bringing sketch performers from like 5 different teams in doing one thing. And
that's a cool idea.
It was a really cool idea, and I wish we would do it more. But I came in to produce it, and like after every sketch, I would say, okay, we'll do this and do this. This is how I think it would be funnier. And to the point where I think it was Amy Frizzy, she was late, she had run a red light or whatever, and she told the cop, you have to let me go without a ticket because my director will be mad at me. And I'm like, well, who's your director? And she said, you are. You are my director. And I said, oh, I'm a director now. So that's when I started directing sketch comedy too. I just had this boost of confidence because she said that. And that's when World of Hurt started. It used to be called Duct Tape Revolution. And we went to like New York and whatever, and then that fell apart for a little while because that's what sketch groups do. And I brought it back, and I brought new people in, and what I realized with World of Hurt is that it could be like Saturday Night Live. As long as I'm sort of at the head of it, we can have a turnover. We can have bring in people. Some people leave. One of our members, sadly, Marcy, just moved to California, and she was really funny. But then we brought in a couple new people, and they're really funny. So we only have three members that we started with 2 years ago, four years ago, Jesus. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. So, and then I, just from doing that, I said, well, I can take on bigger things. And my friend Alan McRae is a director. So he's like, well, you produce things. Do you want to, I don't want to do that stuff. I don't want to do the nitty gritty stuff. I just want to be creative. And I said, well, I'll be your producer. It'll be fine. And so we've launched these big, we did the winter show last year, and we did Comedy America. And, so yeah, so it's been fun. I mean,
people. Producing is oddly addictive, isn't it?
Oh, it really is. Do you produce a lot?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's crazy. I want to keep doing it over and over and over again. You know, and there's so many different ways to produce something. You know, like I, with stand-up, basically what happened with that was I used to go to karaoke at this bar called Radio in Union Square. And I was there so often, I was there with all my comedian friends. And the woman that ran the bar, she said, hey, you have a lot of comedian friends. Do you ever want to do, like, a stand-up night here? I'm like, I don't know anything about stand-up. At this point, stand-up was, it always went for me, for, you know, sketch, improv, and then stand-up was way down, even though I love stand-up, famous stand-ups. And I said, sure, I guess. And I reached out to Matt Kona, because I thought he was really funny. And he put me in contact with all these comedians, and I built a really, like, a dive bar-type comedy night in Radio, and then Radio burned down. So I reached out to Johnny Deese, and I said, hey, is there a night that you don't... I said, I looked on your website. You don't have any comedy. You don't have anything Monday nights at 7. Do you want me to bring in a stand-up show? And they said, yes. And I did that for a year, and then I did the same thing with Phoenix Landing. I reached out, and I said, hey, you don't have comedy on Tuesday nights. Do you want it? And they're like, yes. And it's so funny to me because I hear a lot of people say, you know, I'm trying to get a comedy night off the ground, and it's not happening, and there's no places will take me. And it was so easy for me to find places to do it that I don't understand why people are having trouble with it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's just me or...
Well, I did a variety show at the Middle East. I've been running shows at the improv shows at the Middle East, but for Memorial Day, just because I wanted to try something different, I did a variety show with music, improv, sketch, and stand-up.
Nice.
And I've been, ever since then, stand-ups have been contacting me, like, hey, can I get in on your next show? I'm like, I had no plan on doing a next show, but now I'm like, well, there's enough interest, and I've been to enough open mics where I see there's not enough spots for people to perform a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So there is room, market for this. So I've been shopping around to bars and stuff, but I've actually had a little bit of trouble getting responses back. So I can see
it's,
that a little bit.
It's so strange. I don't know if I must have just gotten lucky because I just, you know, hit at the right time because they weren't, I don't think Johnny was looking for a comedy night. And I just, I laid it all out. I said, here's my plan. I do these things. Like, I write up these manifestos. I'm like, here's the plan that I have. Would you be interested in my plan? And the same thing happened with Phoenix Landing. And it also helped, too, because, you know, I had produced Johnny Deese for a year and a half, and David Thomas had produced The Riot for, like, 6 months at that point. So bringing us both in, and we already had a roster of comedians that wanted to do it. And, you know, it's tricky when you run stand-up nights. You don't want to become like a clubhouse. Because you find out that you have some really great comedians that you just want to see all the time. But you also have to make sure that you're bringing in new people and giving people a chance, but you also don't want it to feel like an open mic.
Right.
You know, you don't want people to just go up there and try brand new material that's not going to work, you know? So it's very difficult sometimes to figure out where the balance is. But that's also fun, you know?
Yeah. I'm trying something like that at, well, I try to work different angles for the shows. So I have like On Point Improv, which is geared towards new groups.
Mm-hmm.
But we also encourage, you know, veteran groups to go there as well. And we have like a spot for, it's called Improv 2, which is the team made up of solo improvisers every time. So if you're a solo improviser, you can just show up and you guarantee a spot to perform.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I just try to look at the different angles of shows because nobody just really wants to go see an improv show when there's, you know, 5,000 other improv shows.
Right, you have to have a hook.
Yeah. And I can see that with stand-up as well.
Well, it's interesting you say that because we're, we try to do not a gimmick show, but like we have a show coming up in August called Bad Sports at Johnny D's, which you can do all the stand-ups can do their regular stuff, but they have to have one joke about Huey Lewis in the news. So Kyle Kinane, he participated in this thing a couple years ago called the Night of 1,000 or 10,000 Bob Segers, and all the stand-ups either did a Bob Seger impression or did jokes about Bob Seger. And I was like, that is the coolest thing, and I wanted to bring that here. So that's happening at Johnny D's. And then in September at Phoenix Landing, we're going to do dual stand-ups. So two microphones, two stand-ups will get on, and they'll work with each other. And some of them have asked me to do it with, Tom Crowley and Owen Linders. They're going to, I think, do one, and then David Thomas and Josh Poirier are going to do one. But some I just put together just because I just wanted to see what would happen. So Lauren Walliser and Steve and Richard Kay are going to do one, and they're in the same sketch group. He's done stand-up once, and she's a regular stand-up, so it's going to be interesting to see that.
Yeah, I've never seen that before, that dynamic at all before.
I'm hoping it's going to be like, Ronan Martin laughing type thing or Smothers Brothers. But it's an experiment, and if it works, I'll keep doing it. I have this one show coming up in October called Working Orange, where I basically found the raunchiest comedians I know, and I'm going to make them do only clean material. So I want to see, because, I have Jordan Handren Seavey, who does jokes about sex and drugs constantly, and I'm going to see if he can do a completely clean set. I think Zenobia Del Mar I'm going to have come up, and she uses the C word in her set. I'm like, you can't do it. You have to be clean. So it's going to be very interesting. I've been trying. It's harder to work the other way around because I know a few clean comics, not as many, and I'm going to have them be dirty, and that's going to be at Phoenix Landing.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's going to be neat.
Cool. If people want to find out about all these shows, is there one specific place they can go?
Place on Facebook. My regular Facebook exists, Kevin Quigley, and then there's Kevin Quigley Artist, and there's a black and white picture of me, which is just so pretentious. and I update that. Follow me. I mean, if you follow me on Facebook, I talk all about my shows. And I promote it there. So that's the best place. I run 3 shows a week, and then I do various other shows. So if you follow me, you can also follow me on Meetup. I am in charge of the Boston Comedy Shows for Free or Cheap Meetup group. So if you go there, I'll tell you all about my shows, and then I'll promote your show if you have anything that's I think the cutoff is $12 and under for a show.
Nice.
So,
what other projects do you want to talk about?
Working on a novel. It's every year I do a Kickstarter novel because I don't get paid for my novels. At least, back in the 70s and 80s, people got advances, even if you were a brand new writer, and it got harder and harder because there were blockbuster writers. So what I do I usually write 2 novels a year. I do one for NaNoWriMo, National Novel Writing Month. It's in October. You're supposed to write a novel a month. And then I do the Kickstarter one usually in September, in February or March. And what I'll do is I'll use that money to basically be my second job, and I'll make sure I deliver. I'll write a novel, and then I'll deliver that. And I have, some perks or whatever. Like the past couple of years, I've been writing personalized poems for people if they hit a certain level. But this year, I decided to do something a little bit more high wire. And I said, okay, I know a lot of you like to read the book that I write, the first draft, after I write it. This time I'm going to let you read it as I write it. So I did the Kickstarter, and now I have this blogspot thing, where I every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I post what I've written in the last couple of days. So you can read the novel in installments.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so that's been fun. So, but that needs to be done by late October because I start the new book in November.
What percentage do you think you're through it?
Probably about a third of the way through right now, which is disheartening. I always think my books are going to be shorter than they are. I
guess this is not a bad problem.
No, it's a good problem. I don't edit as well, you know, at least in the first draft. And so I just let it just flow out of me. And I always go off on these tangents. I'm like, oh, well, she's more interesting this way. So let's explore her backstory for 500 pages. And it's crazy.
I am blown away by, like, I've thought about trying to write, but I just can't think of that many different ways to describe stuff. Like,
it's hard.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, I told you before we started recording, this is my 22nd novel, and I find myself describing things in similar ways. Like, I'm like, I know I've described it like this before in, like, my third book that I wrote in 99. So I have to, like, try to figure out, yeah, you're right, different ways to do it. And you have to stay away from cliches, and you have to, you know, do all this other stuff. And I do find myself hitting a lot of the same territory. Like, most of my books are about young people in Boston who have trouble in romance. And that's about it. So, and I just keep going over that and over that over and over again. But in different ways, you know. And they all have sexual problems. But they all have different sexual problems. So, anyway. But yeah, it's fun.
What else? What else you got going on?
Those are the main thing. I got the three shows a week. I got that going on. What else do I have? I think that's about it. Right now, I'm writing a novel. Oh, I'm writing some nonfiction. A nonfiction book just came out, an ebook called 13 Years. I write books about Stephen King. so I have a publisher, Cemetery Dance, who publishes my books on King. This came out as an ebook, and this is all the essays I've written about Stephen King from the year 2000 to the year 2012. So, because I think, you know, in the 80s and early 90s, there was an explosion of books about King. You know, everybody talking about the phenomenon of him to, you know, studying his work and doing book reviews, and then that sort of ended. So there's not a whole lot that covers his latest stuff. So I thought there definitely should be an accessible book that talks about, because he's doing some really interesting stuff nowadays, and his books are just getting more and more interesting. He's doing his first suspense series, like non-supernatural suspense series right now. So Mr. Mercedes and Finders Keepers just came out, and it's so good. So
cool.
I'm always fascinated by favorite artists that seem to peak in the 80s that are still doing interesting things. So that's my through line. Oh, and the thing I'm working on right now is the Blitz and Trapper, who's a band, Blitz and Trapper, their Wikipedia page. Because they had a boring Wikipedia page, and they said, hey, I wish somebody would make it more interesting. And I said, I'll do it. That's taking up quite a bit of my time.
Stay busy.
Yeah, I don't sleep. So that's fun.
All right. So do you have any shows in the near future you want to just
shout out to? This Thursday at Sketch House is my birthday show. I'm going to be turning 40. So two of my favorite groups, Mr. Bismuth and Vitamin Snake, are going to be doing Sketch.
What's the date on that show?
July 16th. It's at 9 o'clock in Improv Boston. And there's I run this thing called Open House, which is a sketch open mic. And that's going to happen right after that show. And that's a free show to come to. And what you can do is bring in scripts, and our actors will perform them for you on stage. And that's super fun. It's like a party. People come up, and we just laugh about stuff. And you bring in your first drafts, and it's just interesting to have, like, real actors come up and read your scripts, and it's hilarious. So, but that's my, like I said, it's my birthday show. So Mr. Bismuth and Vitamin Snake are apparently doing something for my birthday there.
Nice. And then surprise.
I don't know what it is. And then Connor Allen is going to be hosting and doing stand-up opening. So cool. It's going to be really, really fun. Yeah. So come by. Everyone come by and see my birthday show. I'm going to be 40.
Happy early birthday.
Thank you.
As far as I go, this coming Monday at the Cambridge Y, we have On Point Improv, which is the show I was describing earlier, which is geared towards new groups and has the Improv 2 team. That's from 8 to 10. Next Friday night, I have Rhythm and Laughs at the Riot Theater, which is a combination of music and improv. Next Thursday night, myself and Laura Merley Monotone is our duo group. We'll be at the Riot Theater. And in August, we have me and Mike Cox of Studio 40 in Chico are producing an indie improv team tournament called Bait, Boston Annual Improv Tournament. As of recording, we have 6 spots left out of 24. So if you're interested in signing up your indie team, I would do it in the next few days. And I think most importantly, Improv Cares is a new initiative I just started. It's a volunteer organization of improvisers that we're just trying to get to volunteer improv lessons to organizations in need. So if you know an organization in need, please contact me or Improv Cares email group. And if you're interested in volunteering, there's a sign-up sheet on the Improv Cares Facebook page. So just sign up, even if it's only one day a week or whatever you can do. We're just going to go through the list once we have our first organization signed up, and whoever is available that day will contact. And if you can't do it that day, you know, just, you know, sign up on the list anyway, and we'll contact you. But we just want to get a good group of volunteers signed up. So check that out. But thanks, Kevin.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Have a great night.
You too. And thanks for listening. Bye.